On ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria, this is The Conversation Hour with John Fain.
John Pilger, the veteran left-wing journalist, the polemicist, is one of my guests. He's made a new film called The Coming War on China, and, it's a bit of false advertising. It's not really about a war on China at all, but there is a bit of a theme to it. But John Pilger will be joining us as one of my guests on The Conversation Hour shortly. My co-host for the journey is medical journalist and oncologist Ranjana Srivastava. Morning to you, Dr. Ranjana.
Morning.
How was your summer?
Oh, it was okay. We had our little accidents and traumas. My daughter got into an accident.
I read an article in The Guardian that you wrote. Describe what happened.
Well, we went for a lunch to South Bank. We rode our bikes. We caught the train home. But as we do, we stopped off at a station and decided to ride back home. It was a beautiful day, summer day. And I'm behind her. My son is in the middle, one of my sons. And I hear, oh, my God, I'm going to fall. And I think this happens. And they generally right themselves. Not that you can do much when you're on a bike. And the next thing I heard was an almighty crash, and she had fallen. And when I got there, there was a mangled heap of helmet, bike, child, blood and flesh, which I don't like.
Blood.
And she basically collided with a steel girder that nearly bisected her face. So she was it was a very traumatic accident. I get goosebumps just talking about it. So she injured her face quite badly and broke a few bones. And I was the emergency responder, which is, anyone who knows me just knows how tragic that is.
Sorry, facial bones?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Yes, but she needed trauma surgery.
Okay, you're a doctor. You're on the spot. You're right there. Most people, if they have a bicycle accident, would want a doctor to be on the spot.
Not my kind of doctor, John. So, you know, you freeze. And you know, many, many doctors have said this. It doesn't matter when it's your child or your parent. You stop becoming a doctor. You're a parent first and foremost. And you know, I had enough sort of first aid knowledge to say, okay, I need to check airway, breathing, circulation. She was concussed. She kept saying, just leave me alone. I want to go to sleep. And I'm thinking, no, that's not good. And then these two young men stopped to help. And the first thing I said to them, they went a bit green at the sight of this carnage.
Lots of blood.
And just crying children and you know, panic station. And I said, the first thing I said to these two young men who looked like they probably wouldn't have left the scene, but I think they thought, oh my gosh, what are we going to do? I said, stay there. I'm a doctor. And they stayed because they thought I would direct them what to do. And I said, call an ambulance, get the bikes off the path, get my son off the road because he's wandering off, distressed, and help will arrive. So anyway,
how's your daughter now?
She's very well, thank you. And the column I actually wrote in The Guardian was about how you express gratitude to all the people who come out of the woods to help you, from the ambulance people to the doctors and the nurses. And you really, you know, it's frightening. You feel vulnerable. There's a tsunami of anxiety and panic. And of course, as a parent, double guessing, you know, what could I have done to prevent this? And sort of I concluded in the middle of the night that there's really no real way of saying thank you to these providers, and all you can do is pay it forward.
There's a bit of that, but also sharing the story, and that's what the purpose, I presume, of the article was to make other people think, well, how would I react? Jan and I were driving down a street yesterday and we stopped at the traffic lights, ironically behind a police car. And a man at the tram stop right next to us just keeled over while we were watching. We're sitting there and there's two people at the tram stop and we're just waiting for the lights to change, just, you know, doing what you do, chatting, looking around. And suddenly this man just goes limp, falls over, ends up on his hands and knees and then on his face on the pavement next to us. Just, I thought, my goodness, he's having a heart attack or something. So we alerted the police, jumped out, and suddenly realised how inadequate our first aid training is. and how out of date it is and how you need to refresh it and all the rest of it. And I felt terribly, terribly, just inadequate, useless, and kicking myself going, I should know more about CPR. I should know more about this. I haven't done this stuff for 10 years. I need to know more.
But, you know, on that note, what I found was that the reassurance of strangers standing with you and saying, we will stay with you till help arrives, was so crucial. And these two young guys, I'll never forget, and I wish I knew who they were, and I wish I could thank them in person. The last thing they did was they opened their wallet, which had very few dollars in it, and said, take this money. And then one of them looks at me and says, and you don't need to pay us back, but take this money, you may need it. And I was absolutely touched. We were on bikes, you know, I had $10 tucked in my bike pocket. We just went out for a bike ride. I had nothing on me. And I had never suggested that I needed money. The ambulance was coming. But just sort of thinking, how else can I help someone? And I thought, that is such a wonderful gesture. And you know, we talk so cynically about how people don't have time for each other and the world just moves on and we don't care about each other as much as we used to. And it's, you know, what I saw was that it's not quite like that all the time.
Well, it was certainly, whenever that happens, I'm delighted that your daughter's made a complete and full recovery. That's excellent. And it's also deeply humbling, as we've both discovered, for quite separate reasons. And when that happens and it puts the rest of your life suddenly into acute perspective. Now, tell me about, you're doing something on Radio National, it says on my screen. Radio National, the ABC's upmarket radio service.
Is that how you describe it?
Oh, yeah.
Well, this show is upmarket, I must say.
Of course it is.
So over the summer, before the accident happened, I had the pleasure of going to the homes of three families. And it's something I've often wanted to do, is bring the experience of illness to an audience from the patient's perspective. And what we did was we interviewed three couples. One of them is a brother and sister, and the brother has cystic fibrosis, and he's 12, Harry and Sophie. The second couple was a husband and wife, with the wife who was dealing with advanced cancer. And the third couple is about a vibrant woman who sort of just beautiful and vibrant, who is now battling with dementia, and how the husband and wife are leading their lives as her dementia progresses. So we've essentially followed the lives of these three very different couples in different situations. And it's a three-part series, which is airing on Life Matters at the moment, but is also available as a podcast called An Illness in the Family. And it was just, you know, as a doctor, when you see people in your room and in the clinic, you get such a different perspective. And it's such an edited version of people's lives in that 10 or 20 minutes you spend with them. And going into these people's houses and really sort of getting an intimate portrait of what it's like, really like, living with an illness for a young boy at the cusp of, you know, what he dreams of, having a football career. And then this young woman who has advanced cancer and who has followed alternative treatments and is now dying. And then a woman with dementia. And she knows just enough to know that she has dementia and very much fears the future and how the couple navigates that. It's fascinating.
So it's not about the medicine, by the way you're describing it.
It's about the lives of these people, absolutely. And you know, I think so very often in medicine we forget that. We forget about the human experience of illness, and that's what I've tried to capture. And, you know, by the time the editors work on it and snip out all the awkward bits and put in some music and all of that, it's really good. And it's such a beautiful portrayal of these people's lives. So I'd really encourage people to listen to it.
On Radio National, it's called An Illness in the Family, and you can get it from the Radio National website, which is part of the ABC. That's right. It's part of ABC Radio. It's the Radio National Talk Network, which is the companion, the upmarket companion to what you're listening to right now on ABC Local Radio. Dr. Ranjana Srivastava, oncologist and medical journalist, columnist for The Guardian, and author of the book After Cancer, A Guide to Living Well, is my co-host on The Conversation Hour today. Joining us shortly, there's a new show coming to the Malt House about the Chinese one-child policy. It's written by one of our guests, Lachlan Philpott, and stars, amongst others, the actor Alice Shin. It's called Little Emperors. Our first guest, though, John Pilger, the proudly left-wing contrarian journalist, award-winning journalist over many, many years, has made a new film. It's called The Coming War on China. John Pilger is our first guest. John Pilger, welcome back to The Conversation.
Thank you. Very good to be here, John.
There's a touch of false advertising in the title of this film because there's a lot about things other than China and not a lot about a war.
I think it's a lot about a war. I heard you say that in the preamble. I was rather astonished. Have you seen it?
Yes, I have. I've watched it from beginning to end.
It's
mostly about Marshall Islands, Bikini Atoll, Okinawa.
No, that's only one chapter. Most of the war, in fact, there's a whole section about the real possibility of nuclear war and how the doomsday clock, that is the threat of nuclear war, has edged closer with the provocation of not only China, but of Russia as well. But China is the latest provocation. That's the one we now are being told to worry about with President Trump. And he's made outright threats to China. I think what's interesting about China, you're quite right, it isn't all about war. It's also about media. The point I make at the beginning of the film is that China, in a political sense and in a threat sense, does appear on the news as a country building airstrips in the South China Sea and therefore threatening the region. What is left out of the news is that China itself is surrounded by 400 American military bases with missiles, bombers, ships, and that's a very, very threatening situation.
China's trying to change the power balance, and it depends on what you regard as your starting point, whether you think it should change or not.
Well, China, the only power balance that really has changed is the extraordinary rise of China.
Yeah.
As an economic power, yes.
Empire, all make China great again.
I think China is a massive economic power, and it's... I don't think it's an imperial power. Obviously, any great economic power spreads its influence. But it's not an imperial power in the sense of the 19th century imperialists. And we still have those. We have those in the United States, and we have those at least in the thinking in Britain and others. I don't think China wants to expand militarily, but it is expanding, certainly through Africa, in its development, in its swapping infrastructure for resources. It is the world's most populous society. And that the United States coming to terms with that there is a great economic power actually challenging its all-over dominance of the world, that's what the issue is today. The Americans really don't like that.
And, you know, and I guess to an observer, you might think, well, why not? Just as the United States is entitled to build its empire and et cetera, so is China. And I just wonder, after the recent American election where, you know, we had the president we could never, ever have had, when you say the coming war on China, does the media and do you make it a fait accompli by writing about it or by saying that it is going to happen? I mean, what's in it for China?
Is John Pilger's fault if there's a war?
Ranjana, I have to ask you the question I've asked John. You told me before we came on you hadn't watched the film. Now, I don't think it is completely right that you're asking me about a work that you haven't seen.
I've watched sections of it that I
That's
was sent.
Not the film.
I haven't seen the whole film. But I'm asking you that, you know, you say that there's a coming war on China. And regardless of the film, my question is, does it become a fait accompli if we keep talking about it? And what's in it for China to fight this war? And why is this not saber-rattling on all parts?
So by saying that there is a threat, we should, what are you suggesting? That we should not discuss something, that we should not debate it? There are a lot of people who would be very pleased if we didn't. And up to now, there has been, when I started making this film 2 years ago, there was almost no discussion about the bases that I've just mentioned, about the fact that the United States was moving what they call the pivot to Asia, two-thirds of its naval forces into the Asia-Pacific in a very provocative way. There was absolutely no discussion about that. So, yes, the coming war on China, as a title, would be seen as provocative. It's interesting seeing it go from being provocative to, if not a reality, but a real possibility under Trump, when Trump now is openly threatening a nuclear power. Now, that doesn't mean to say that he's threatening to go to war with China, but it is wars sort of, don't begin like that. They can begin accidentally.
They can. They usually do. In fact, yeah. The saber-rattling thing. Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi has just been visiting Australia and had high-level meetings and long discussions with Julie Bishop, and they've both come out of it and held a joint press conference saying that really it's not in anyone's interest to keep on going down this saber-rattling path. And indeed, the Americans are backpedaling. U.S. State Secretary of State Rex Tillerson and the new heads of military that Donald Trump has appointed are all saying, look, you know, some of that's just playing to the crowd. It's not really the way we're going to conduct ourselves. Does that reassure you in any way?
It's not, well, as far as China is concerned, the what I got in China was a real, first, people were bemused, some of them, and others were quite frightened. One said a most sensible thing. He said, and this was the strategist, he said, look, I don't understand this. The whole thing is unnecessary. Why should we have a war with the United States? There are big, you know, we trade with them more than anywhere else. All our elite, or most of our elite, are educated there. Why should we have a war with them? But if we are ordained the enemy of the United States, and that then begins to get out of control, in other words, if we are made an enemy, then we have to prepare. And China in the last 3 or 4 years has prepared at a pace.
Military?
Yes, up to $150 billion. That's a massive rise. I mean, they've developed a missile that they claim could effectively destroy the U.S. Navy in the South China Sea around them. So they're rapidly. They've also, the most worrying thing, as I mentioned in the film, that they've taken their nuclear missiles off low alert to high alert.
Mm-hmm.
That means the warheads now are connected.
Everyone's posturing.
Everyone's posturing. That is a major development.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
the Chinese military have never been tested in combat. The Chinese Navy, Army, Air Force are actually competing units, according to the survey in The Economist last year, which did an in-depth look at China's military growth and said they're actually competing business interests. They've never been tested in combat. Their computer systems and the like are thought to be deficient. And if there was a war, China knows it would lose. Well, so it's not in China's interest to go down that path.
John, that's The Economist's view. The United States hasn't been tested against a major power. The United States doesn't usually attack major powers, not since the Second World War. So it hasn't been tested, and its own services compete famously with each other. So I think that's going down a fairly sterile path, because both have nuclear weapons and both are aimed at each other. And there's a section in the film in which Stephen Starr, who's an expert on this, describes what would happen in
mutual
one exchange
deterrence
between China.
Yeah. It's back to the Cold War, mutual deterrence, mutual destruction.
Well, no, there isn't. I think in the Cold War, the mutual assured destruction, what was known as detente, was a much safer, sounds bizarre, but a much safer state of affairs, because there were red lines that you didn't cross. Now those red lines are being crossed. You have American ships in Chinese waters. You have the Australians and the Americans with a military exercise in 2015, which Operation Talisman Sabre, which was effectively rehearsing the blockade of China. Now, that would not have happened during the Cold War. It was a standoff.
John, I have a question for you regarding the line in the sand. So in Syria, President Obama had a line in the sand. It was crossed. nothing happened. Action wasn't taken with regard to the chemical warfare, etc. I just wonder from
well,
from
he
your...
was shown that he was wrong about the he claimed that the Syrians had exploded chemical weapons, and as Seymour Hersh and others showed, he hadn't. So he didn't really have a line in the sand there.
So what do you think, from your analysis, will be the line in the sand with China that will provoke a president like President Trump to attack China? Or do you think, or who do you think will fire the first shot?
I don't think it's as simple as that, to be with all respect. I just don't. I think things, as we know from recent history of the last century, wars can happen almost insidiously, but they're not insidious if you have nuclear weapons. That's the difference. Because there was a panel in the United States headed up by General Cartwright that showed that there is less than 12 minutes to make a decision. If you feel that you're being attacked and your nuclear capability is at risk, then you fire first. It's a Kafkaesque world, and decisions have to be made within 12 minutes. I think we've got out of the habit of being worried about nuclear weapons.
John, the greatest atrocity being committed, the greatest atrocities being committed anywhere in the world today at the moment are in Syria with the Russian-backed regime of Assad.
So Amnesty
15,000 people tortured and hanged in prisons there.
Have you read the report?
And I've looked at the reports of the report. I haven't read the Amnesty's report. I think we can rely on it.
I think some terrible things have happened there, but
little
I'm not
doubt.
Sure
chemical weapons being used in Syria?
No, there were chemical weapons. Seymour Hersh, probably the best journalist in the world, put paid to that. They weren't used in Syria by the Syrians. They were used by the other side. Undoubtedly, the Assad regime has done the most horrific things in Syria. I wouldn't call that the greatest atrocity. It competes, doesn't it? There are quite a few. And I question some of Amnesty's reports.
Why?
In recent years haven't quite had, in my opinion, the rigor that they might have once had. So this is based on about four or five witnesses within the prison system. Undoubtedly,
including
something like this happened.
And defectors from the Assad regime themselves.
Well,
who
we
insiders.
Remember all we about a million people were killed in Iraq, thanks famously to Iraqi defectors who came with cock and bull stories to the United States. I'm not comparing them, but all I'm saying is journalistically we should be skeptical, even if it has the hallowed name of Amnesty on it.
That brings up an interesting question that I often ponder, John. I mean, when we talk about competing atrocities, of course, what's happening with the Rohingya Muslims in Myanmar is another very, very troubling scenario, and we rarely seem to talk about it. But, you know, you just put quite a bit of stock in, say, Seymour Hersh, and you perhaps you think, I don't know, but perhaps you think he has the definitive word. He's a good journalist. At the same time, you cast doubt on Amnesty or a Red Cross report.
I cast doubt on government propaganda mostly.
Right. But to the average listener, how does one differentiate then as to, you know, whom to trust, when to trust them? And I guess this also has a bearing on, say, you put out a film. So how do we know what to trust and how much?
Well, when you see a film like this, you look at the evidence and you weigh the evidence. And if that evidence convinces you, then you invest in it some trust. If it doesn't, you don't. I agree with you. I think a problem, when you said the Rohingya, you're absolutely right. That is an enormous atrocity that only recently, in recent years, have we come round to understanding why. And I think that is, in the early days, that was media protected. And it was mostly media protected because somebody, and I know her and know her probably well, the media protected Aung San Suu Kyi, who has effectively apologized for the killings, but apologized for the silence around the killings.
So what faith does one then place in the integrity of a media that puts a code of silence, a blanket of silence around an atrocity like that, but then perhaps, just perhaps, plays up the risk with China?
Well, look, Ranjan, we're all intelligent people. We're appearing on a distinguished ABC program. We have the privilege of the internet. We have all the access to information if we want it, and if we want to analyze it and form our own judgment. We're not young children in this, are we? We do have the capacity. Most of all, we have the privilege of being able to access all this information. And I think it does, if people are interested, if they have the will, they can almost get round this media selectivity of Syria bad, Burma good,
sure,
or something.
Good
and
bad.
The Kurds used to be, there used to be good and bad Kurds, as you remember.
Mm.
Depends which side of the ideological fence they're on. The same often applies to Syria today. I think it's up to us, really.
John Pilger's new film, very, very thought-provoking, The Coming War on China. Now, Alice Shin and Lachlan Philpott join us. Lachlan's a playwright and Alice is an actor. And they're here to tell us about a show coming to the Malt House, which is about China's one-child policy. Alice, Lachlan, good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Who can explain this play to us? Alice, you're in it. What happens?
What happens? Well, many things. We deal with the ramifications of the one-child policy, including situations like the illegal children that get hidden away. And also, my character has a bit of a story because she's 31 and still unmarried, and so she's part of the generation of women who are kind of left on the shelf and constantly feel the pressure of that coming from the family. Something that I recognize all too well in the play. It was kind of frightening when I first read it, how much it mirrored my own life.
But you're an actor. You didn't write this. It was written
for you. No, I didn't. It was written exactly for me, I thought. Yes, Lachlan did this for me.
So, Lachlan, what's the storyline?
It does follow... it's based on the one-child policy, but it follows a brother and sister, and the sister was first born. And then the brother was born second and kept as a secret child. And so it kind of follows their story. But I think it tries to take in a whole kind of varied generation. It's hard because there are so many stories with the one-child policy. And, you know, if you've only got four actors to work with, then you can't tell them all. I mean, I think you could write thousands of plays about the one-child policy.
So how did
and they'd all be very different
stories. How did you research it?
I was lucky enough to go to China.
Whereabouts?
I went to Beijing.
Beijing?
Yeah, unfortunately. I couldn't go for any longer, but I got to spend some time there. I also talked to a huge amount of people who, in Australia and also in the US and in China, who one child policy people. And also spent a lot of time with a theatre group in Sydney, the Cathay Theatre Group in Ashfield, and that was really interesting because I think it took a long time for people to really open up and tell their stories. I kind of went back each week, and then gradually people opened up and you know, really told me their stories.
It's probably one of the greatest examples of social engineering that human civilization has ever seen, and the devastation and the impact that it has is incalculable. One of the most moving things I've ever experienced in Western China, in a tiny little town out near Urumqi, and a woman begging for money, and we were having breakfast on the side of the road, and she came over and we gave her some money and bought them breakfast, and there was a little girl there who just had the most extraordinary eyes, and we realised after 5 or 10 minutes of no language and all the rest of it that, in fact, she was blind. And with our translator, in the end, the story was, this was a little girl. When she was born blind, she was abandoned. And the woman who we were with, the woman who was begging, had adopted this blind child because she was a street urchin. And there was an operation that would return this girl's sight, and they couldn't afford to get to the hospital in order to have the operation. That's how desperate things were. It was an extraordinary thing. And you just think the way this policy has impacted on people's lives, because here's a family, because they couldn't have any more children, they didn't want to be saddled with a disabled one, so they just abandoned it in the hope that the next child would be a better offering for them.
Yeah,
it was,
and there
just
so many heartbreaking
incredible
stories of that. You know, so many children who never even got to breathe, to see, you know, to look into their mother's eyes, or you know, to never. I think that life, the price of life was so different during that time, and there's an incredible amount of sad stories. And then, you know, at the other end of the scale, there is the little emperors. You know, this generation of very indulged young people who've been looked after by two parents and four grandparents and have kind of had every wish catered to. And I think, you know, that there's such disparity there as well. It's very interesting territory.
Well, it's you know, juxtaposed to your story, John. Just the very title of your film, Little Emperors, took me back to medical school, where I grew up, where I studied with self-confessed little emperors. And so the title just rang a bell with me immediately. And, you know, what was extraordinary was the majority of us would be classified as struggling students, like many students are. And then we had this coterie of Asian friends who were lovely and who were very helpful. And, you know, it was quite extraordinary. They had a new car, and one of them crashed his car. His parents bought him a new car again, and we just sort of looked gobsmacked. Mobile phones were just coming in when we were medical students, and they cost, you know, a princely $500-$600 at the time. They were like as big as bricks. And guess who had them? The little emperors had them. Yeah. And then the thing that probably is etched in my brain, some of my friends used to bring in blank checks to the medical bookshop to buy textbooks, which were really expensive. Everyone knows that medical textbooks cost hundreds of dollars. And most of us would be thinking, well, how can we get by with photocopying this book? Or let's check out the secondhand bookshop. Let's put out a call. And then we had these, and they were inevitably little emperors, not so many little empresses, who brought blank checks into the bookshop. And the rest of us would just look on and sigh. And, you know, the irony of it all was, some of those books would be unwrapped the day before the exam. And it was astonishing to me and quite an extraordinary insight into this aspect of culture.
But that's a standard migrant thing, isn't it, where nothing is too good for your children. I mean, that's universal. It's not. I don't know that's unique to Chinese culture. I mean, my Jewish heritage was the same. You invested everything in your kids' education.
Yeah.
Because that was the key to breaking out of your refugee arrival.
But this
it's also the hallmark of a rapidly rising bourgeoisie, isn't it? Mm. And I think in India you have plenty of little emperors, where I always feel the Indian bourgeoisie are among the most isolated in the world. You have most of the country in dire straits, hungry farmers taking their own lives. And yet in the cities, a whole little emperor's culture, you could say, that is built around a very isolated bourgeoisie. I was going to ask you, what's the impact of the extraordinary change in China, where something like 500 or 600 million people created this new middle class? What's the effect today of that on the one-child policy? Because that's an enormous social change, an enormous economic change, the greatest change probably ever in China.
Yeah, and I mean, I think there's also concern about the future population in China, because I think now that the one-child generation are also choosing to have one child, even though the policy's been relaxed. And so, you know, the question of population growth and sustaining an aging population, I think, is you know, a very big one to deal with. Mm. And I also think that, you know, you have, I mean, I was very interested in it too, because I think there's a very different mentality. And I think you're right when you say, John, about, you know, that there are migrants from many places who want the best for their children. But there's a slight difference in the sense that there's only one. And so all of the hopes and everything gets channeled into this one child. And that puts an enormous amount of pressure on that person. And it seems to me, I mean, and I don't claim to be any expert, but the people who I've spoken to, what often comes to is stories of resentment, and, you know, and stories of very difficult family relations, simply because the child resents the pressure that they get. And the need to be so successful. And sure. So I think it does. I mean, yeah, it's very complex.
And there are significant physical and mental health consequences that I'm hearing about when there's a single child looking after aging parents, trying to manage their own family. You know, it's a burden that is that I think was unexpected and unprecedented on single children.
Yeah.
Alice, as a Australian Chinese,
yes,
is it a play that's for the Australian Chinese community, or is it a play for the rest of Australians to understand the context of Chinese culture, the impact of the one-child policy?
That's an interesting question. I really think that it's a play for the rest of, well, actually for everyone, because it speaks so true to the immigrant diaspora, but also the scenes that are set in Beijing are so just absolutely true of what it is like in China. So I really do think that he opens it up to everyone. Lachlan has managed to touch upon just the very specific feelings of isolation and that pressure in a way that I think speaks true to everyone.
You've got a bit of an American twang.
Yes, I spent 7 years in New York. I only just moved back to Australia last year. And, yeah, stepping back into, like, a family situation where my mother is, finally. It's actually been interesting because another symptom of the one-child policy is that there are this generation of kids who are so successful, like, in all these other ways, except they can't do anything for themselves. Mm-hmm. My mother's friends are surprised that I can cook for myself, that I can do my laundry, which, you know, obviously I'm a 31-year-old woman. Of course I can do these things, but it's not expected anymore because these kids, these people who are my peers, they can have successful careers, but life-wise, they are still falling behind.
How hard is it to resist the pressure of your parents and their peers' family pressure to conform with what's expected of a young person in the Australian Chinese community, a young woman?
Well, my life has been a series of progressive failures for my mother.
Rebellion.
Yes, absolutely. The fact that I'm an actor to begin with, the fact that I want to pursue the arts has been very tough on my mother. And all my friends that I went to school with who are of Chinese background, they are pretty much all lawyers and doctors. And, you know, the fact that I'm not is not a comfort to my mother.
Alice, that story sounds incredibly familiar to me, of course, because it is also true of children of South Asian heritage, although I must say my household must be the only one where doctor was never mentioned until I became one and everyone said, oh, my God, you did. but I think that I sense that in the South Asian community, the tide is slowly turning. And I do see children who do well and, God forbid, go into accounting and go into events management. I mean, these are kids
About carpenters?
Not too many of them, but that's probably because, you know, I think a lot of Indians, South Asians, still aspire to professional university bound careers. But it is interesting that slowly we are seeing that it's okay not to do medicine or law or even engineering and do something that your heart desires. And it's really nice to see because, you know, it puts a tremendous amount of pressure on a child.
Yeah.
Sure, it's not
of
all
course.
That long ago when it was a bit like that here. I when I was at Sydney High School, there were two of us. One was Jack Thompson, a slightly different time than me, but just a couple of years different. Myself and one or two others, I wanting to be a journalist, Jack wanting to be an actor, in a school that cranked out all these doctors and lawyers and classic students, so-called. Parents didn't like it, you know.
Well, I think it has a lot to do with the industry. The more that these parents of Asian children can see other people of Asian descent succeeding in the industry, then they will be more supportive.
Andrew, Lachlan, the play is on Little Emperors, and we're going to see Alice strutting her stuff. The rest of the cast, you're working with people who are not established names because they're coming from an emerging community in the arts. How hard is it to get them to fulfil your vision, to get them to...
Well, look, Chong Wang is the director who's from Beijing, and I think he's probably better to answer that question. I'm actually in the position of just coming down to Melbourne today, and I'm about to see the first run of it. So it's a little bit nerve wracking to go and see the dress rehearsal for the first time. But
I think it's also like Alice, who's done more waitressing than acting in recent times, according to her CV.
Yeah, but then I think that's probably the situation for most people who are working in the arts now as well. You know that. I think it's really important that we have we're giving people new people an opportunity to be on the main stage, and that we're actually reflecting the diversity of our society on the main stages of our theatres. So it's very exciting in that way, and I think it's also very important to be attracting audiences from different backgrounds as well. So I think for me it's a very exciting project in that sense.
And it also expands on what it is to have an Australian story, which is not all about people mustering cattle in the outback.
And hearing that kind of ochre accent that we've come to think of as being Australian theatre, and I think Australian theatre really needs to expand its depictions and vocabulary in a lot of ways.
Alice, I've never read an actor's bio, but I'm fascinated to see that it mentions such things as your eye colour and your height and your hair,
yes.
And then how many accents you can do. And yes. I've always wanted to ask someone, is it really difficult to master accents?
Absolutely. I don't know what sound comes out of my mouth at any given moment. For me, it's about just living within an accent for an extended period of time and constantly being saturated by it.
Do you have a coach for each accent?
Yes, if one is available, absolutely.
And I see that it says Asian upon request.
Reluctantly upon request.
Right. Why is that?
You mean Asian accent upon
yes.
request?
Yes.
I don't think Alice is Asian.
Accent. Under accent. Yes. Is Asian on request.
I'm glad we clarified that. Thanks, Rangela. So do you mean like the stereotypical...
Yes. I get called into auditions for the geeky Asian, and they'll say, can you put on an Asian accent? And they won't specify which. They'll just say Asian. And I have to pick one, I guess.
Right.
Which is, I mean, well, I guess whether we like it or not, like when we stereotype people all the time in the name of art.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, it's unfortunate. But, I mean, hopefully, I think projects like this actually will allow that to start changing. But, it is a bit sad, isn't it, to hear that's still going on. It's like I've got a friend who's got Greek background, and when she graduated from NIDA, they recommended that she change her name from the Greek name to be much more anglified.
And
when do we stop doing this in Australia?
It's and we're seeing a bit of a backlash now. In fact, it came up when Waleed won the Gold Logie and everything. There was lots of stuff said about it. And it's really good that this is premiering in Melbourne, which is significant as well.
Yeah.
And, Melbourne and Victoria, proudly multicultural, proudly diverse, by and large most of the time harmonious, and breaking new ground with some of the emerging communities in the arts as well as in other ways. So that's fantastic too.
Yeah, it's great.
Congratulations. Lachlan Philpott is the playwright of Little Emperors, directed by Wang Chong, a Malthouse theatre production. And the Malthouse are putting this on together with Asia Topa. It's a festival of Asian theatre and art. Alice?
Yes.
Good luck.
Thank you very much.
May there be no more waitressing for you.
Praise
good luck. And when indeed actors of different ethnicity are cast regardless in a blind casting, we'll know that finally we're not putting any weight on some of those sorts of stereotypes anymore. Alice Shen and Lachlan Philpott from Little Emperors at the Malthouse. John Pilger has made a new film called The Coming War on China. It screens from today at the Cinema Nova, and Ranjan is my co-host. Thank you all for coming. This has been The Conversation Hour on your ABC.